Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Early in the set, I can signal to the audience, like, I'm looking at you. I see you. I hear you. And I want you to be part of this. Then I'm like setting that tone. It's kind of like my mom gave me advice when I was a little kid. She was like, when you go to a party, just get on the dance floor.
Welcome to Behind the Setlist, the podcast where artists tell the stories about the songs they perform live. I'm Jay Gilbert from Label Logic.
And I'm Glenn Peoples from Billboard. In this episode, we talk to Christine Flaherty, known professionally as Kayflay. You may know her for the songs Blood in the Cut and High Enough from her early albums for Interscope Records. Her fifth and latest studio full-length album, Mono, was released in September 2023 by Giant Music. She's also done a handful of EPs going back to her 2010 self-released debut.
So sit back, relax, while we go behind the set list with Kayflay. Let it roll. Christine, so great to see you. Thank you for joining us today. We were looking at one of your set lists. This one just happened to be from London on October 3rd. And there were like seven songs from Mono, which I thought was amazing that you would play that much material. And then when I went and got into the album, I sort of understood why. There's a familiarity to it on the first time you listen to it. And I think that's easier said than done. A couple of songs really jumped out at me, and you know, we'll certainly talk about Perfectly Alone in a second, but you open with Are You Serious and Rah Rah. Holy cow. I mean, it comes out guns blazing. Tell us about how you craft your set list.
So set lists are always exciting and challenging. They are particularly exciting and challenging when you've just put out a new record and you have a bunch of other records. You know, I would like to say I'm at this incredibly exciting point in my career, and I never even like knew I would have this problem, which is that, you know, you begin as a musician and you've got nothing. You know, you're like, oh God, how do I fill 45 minutes? How do I fill an hour? Because you're building your material, you're building your repertoire. And, you know, Mono's my fifth studio record, got a bunch of EPs, got a bunch of mixtapes, collabs, everything. So it's like, now I'm really curating this experience because there's a lot of material to work with. So I think just setting that up as context, for me, it was really important to say, okay, there's a reason I started the record with Are You Serious into Rah Rah. There's a reason the record goes like that. Because I'm curating an experience for the listener. And in the same way, I'd like to curate that same jarring experience for my audience in the live setting. And I love personally when I go to a show and there are elements of the live show that are just mimic the record. And I don't mean it like, oh, the song sounded just like it sounded on the record, because I don't love that. But what I do love is like song order, pacing, things like that. I love it because I'm like, it makes me feel really connected in it. For me as a listener, I'm able to understand, I guess, the artist's intent in a deeper way. And for me, Are You Serious is a confrontational, odd song. And that was the setup for this record for me in my life, which is that I suddenly went deaf in one ear. I was confronted with an odd, jarring experience and forced to really ask myself the question, hey, Christine, are you serious? And I will tell you, in the set, I put a really long pause. So there's a tinnitus noise in the song on the record, which is like the noise I hear in my ear. We extend it a really long time for the live set. So basically I go, sometimes I wake up from this side of me like, and I go, London. Well, because you're saying London. London, I'm screaming. Are you ready? People clap. Look him dead in the eye. Are you serious? I'm like screaming it. And people are like, and then there's another pause. And then the drum kick. You know, but this tension of like, are you fucking with me? And like, to me, that's a very powerful way to begin the live experience. And I love, by the way, I love one of my favorite things the more I've toured and is like, how do we play with tension? How do you make moments on stage that are really quiet? Like what would happen, right? If you said to the crowd, everybody, shh. You know, there's energy in that, you know? There's energy in being loud, but there's energy in being quiet. I think that's another goal in terms of like the topography of the set, right? Like is having those moments. So
yeah.
So you're engaging your audience right from the start. You're getting them into the show with these first songs.
Absolutely. I everybody's got a different style. Every performer has a different style. I have found that I think when I'm performing, if really early in the set, I can signal to the audience, like, I'm looking at you, I see you, I hear you, and I want you to be part of this, then I'm like setting that tone. It's kind of like my mom gave me advice when I was a little kid. She was like, when you go to a party, just get on the dance floor. Like, first thing you do, just get on the dance floor. And it was excellent advice. Because if you just start off dancing, you can always like leave and then come back, you know, but it's when you build up that kind of like space or that fear, it's harder and harder. So I feel like in a way it's kind of breaking the ice. It's just like, hey, you're here, I'm here. Like, we both, you know, probably have to pee right now or something, you know, like we're just people. We're just at the show. I'm at the show. You're at the show. And by the way, I would never have to pee on stage because I pee literally like 10 times before I get on stage. So I definitely do not have to.
What size venues have you been playing? So you're creating this interaction, this relationship with the fans right off. And what's the room like? What's the ability to connect?
So I guess if we just take this London show, it kind of varies. So that London show is probably 1500 capacity venue. So, you know, a lot of the places I'm playing are, you know, large club, small theater. But that being said, there are other venues we play, you know, depending on the market and just, you know, other factors that are a little smaller or a little bigger. We played, we did a couple smaller shows in Europe that were like, we played a show in Vienna that's probably like 800 people, like the hottest show I've ever played in my life. Like I actually thought I actually took my shirt off, which I've historically never done. I was so hot, you know, so there are some shows that are really intimate and some shows smaller than that. Where I'm getting ready for this coming spring. We're doing something we've never done before, and it's going to be a real experiment in set list, which is 7 cities in the U.S. and also Toronto. 2 nights in each city, same venue, small venue. So we're doing like 600 cap rooms, different set list each night, really intimate. Like,
oh wow,
everyone can see everyone. And with the idea being, I think again, let's make some tension. Let's see what happens. Let's change the circumstances and see what kind of experience we can have. Because, like, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to, you know, do music, tour and make music for a living, you know, and play, you know, some great venues. But it's like, well, maybe you went and saw me at the Wiltern in June or whatever. Do you really want to go see me again at the Wiltern the next June? Like, I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
So you get to stay in the benefit as you get to stay in the same city 2 nights in a row, maybe a little less traveling, and then you get a bigger playlist ultimately across 2 shows to bring to people. Is that it?
Correct. And also just, I'm planning, I'm working on it right now, but, like, you know, it's a smaller venue means smaller stage, which means more limitations on production. Now there's one, you know, that at first can feel dispiriting or limiting, right? Or that could be one take on it. I think the other take, which is how I'm approaching it, is like, okay, well, these are constraints. Constraints pretty much always lead to something interesting. So, like, how can we take these constraints and put on a show that people haven't seen before, you know, and take the knowledge that we have from playing in lots of different types of venues and say, like, hey, we're, you know, coming to Bowery Ballroom in New York City, but we're going to take these ideas and, like, you're going to leave that show being like, well, that was creative. You know, and that's kind of what that's been my goal now that I've got more of a sense of, you know, how to play a show and what the fuck I'm doing. Because it took me, by the way, I should note, it took me many years to figure out just how to, you know, just how to be up there with a microphone and, like, kind of,
yeah,
do the basic thing.
Talk a little bit about your collaborations and how they inform your decisions about your live show. I know you've done some touring with 30 Seconds to Mars and others. You've done collaborations with, you know, Tom Morello, Imagine Dragons. How have those collaborations sort of helped you craft your headlining show?
I think in 2 ways. The first way is that anytime you collaborate, you're invited into somebody else's creative process and outlook. And whenever that happens, your outlook, you know, inevitably has the opportunity to be expanded. So I think, you know, every time I collaborate with somebody, I'm like, oh, that's how, oh, you put the amp like this, or you do, you know, you're just kind of observing these ways of, you know, setting things up in the live space or in the studio space, a way of singing, a way of approaching, a way of writing. And that, I think, in a less sometimes tangible, sometimes intangible way, informs how I'm approaching the performance. And then I think the second way, and this is probably the more impactful way for me, at least, is that collaboration kind of gives you license to break your own rules a little bit. You know, we often, it's like, you know, imagine you're doing some activity alone and then you're doing some activity with a friend. Well, if your friend suggests a crazy idea, you'll probably do that crazy idea. You know, you'll be down for it, even though it's not your ordinary way of being. And so I think just the very nature of collaboration allows you to be a little bit more experimental and less caught up in, like, quote unquote, this is how I do things. And so I think that's been the biggest impact of collaboration, is that it's loosened me from the vice grip of my own rules. And that's been very, I think it's a big part of, like, just my own longevity and just maintaining, like, honestly, joy and, like, happiness and curiosity in this world, you know, is remaining loose and unattached.
Jay told me about some interesting stat just before we got on the call with you. And Jay, bring that up, and it says something about your status in the, and I don't want to misinterpret this, maybe your status in the artistic community. What is that stat, Jay?
The stat is that we look at things called network respect, and that rating comes from when influential people follow you, and you have, like, an incredibly high network respect. You're followed on socials by the Chainsmokers, Macklemore, Imagine Dragons. Those are the types of things that will jack that score up. And we were talking a little bit beforehand, and you and I, before we hit record, talked a little bit about people who are influential in writing lyrics, for example. And that's what Glenn and I were talking about, is that it's just crazy how all of these very successful, influential people, they're following you. They're looking at you.
Well, it's, you know, I think the community of musicians, it really is like a dialogue. I don't know. I just think, you know, I've never, I haven't actually heard, you know, that term or that kind of way of measuring things or looking at things. But, you know, every musician I know, myself included, we're all in conversation with one another, thinking about how do we approach this endeavor, you know, the live endeavor, the studio endeavor, the social media endeavor, which is kind of its own behemoth at this point. You know, it certainly feels good to be, you know, well regarded and respected in your community. I think what's been kind of cool for me and just allowed me to, again, fly kind of free. I mean, it's been a blessing and a curse, but, or not a curse, but it's just that I've always been a little bit, like, in my own lane, a little kind of, yeah, in between genres, and a little bit, like, never totally, like, fitting exactly in a place or in a scene. And at times I've, you know, I've lamented that, you know, or I've yearned for the feeling of sort of kind of quote unquote fitting in. But I think, you know, the flip side of that is it's allowed me, you know, this kind of in-betweenness has allowed me to do a lot of different things, and, you know, and to really kind of, like, inhabit my own creativity and authenticity, and not to get too bogged down in, you know, the expectations, yeah, of the genre or the whatever, because there is no genre.
Yeah, one thing you've talked about, you've been very open about recently, is mental health, and, you know, talking about the artistic community. I'm wondering if you think that that's a topic that's a little more fair game, that people are a little more interested in talking about. You know, in recent years, there have been some artists who have, you know, postponed shows for mental health reasons, where I think that's generally seen as a really positive development. In years past, they just would have suffered through it and gone on with the show. And now they're taking that more seriously, which seems different and really positive. And I'm wondering how you see the artistic community and your peers talking about this issue.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more openness and vulnerability around mental health. And I think it's, you know, I do think it's a reflection of the culture at large. I had an interesting conversation I was actually doing an interview about mental health, and we talked about a little bit the trap of self-awareness, and not to take this into like a big tangent, but I think this is really interesting because, you know, there is the temptation at times to identify the issues or the problem and to feel like in that identification or in that awareness lies the solution. Or like the awareness itself is the goal. And I would argue the awareness certainly is a part of developing the tools to then deal with whatever's going on, but it's kind of merely step one. And I think as a culture, we've gotten a lot better at that step of awareness, but I don't know. I think we still have a long way to go across the music industry and as a culture in terms of how do we actually cultivate the development of tools for people to deal with. So it's like, okay, well, now we know there's a problem. How do we really deal with this thing? You know, you talk to a lot of people and they're like, yeah, I'm dealing with X, Y, and Z. And of course, that's a very important dialogue to have. And one of the things that I just find cropping up among a lot of people I know is they're like, hey, I'm dealing with this, but I don't know what to do next. I actually don't know what comes after this. And not that I have the answer for anyone else. I have some answers for myself, but I think, I guess it's a tempered way of saying, yes, I think we've come a long way in terms of this discourse that we're having, but I think we're sort of still in phase one. And I would love to see us just continue to push further. Because, you know, we're living in a complicated world. Like there's a lot of, just in terms of like sheer information that any individual human is confronted with on a daily basis. It's vast. It's, yeah. You know, and I think, I'm encouraged that there's openness and vulnerability about like, hey, I'm struggling, you know, because that admission in and of itself is really important, that we see that across the board, that like the human struggle transcends everything, right? Like babies are struggling, elderly people are struggling. We're all in this thing together. The fabric of human suffering is what unites us. And that's like a beautiful thing. So is the fabric of human joy. Like it's all part of the same blanket or whatever, but I do see, you know, that beyond the disclosure of struggle, we still got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, it's a lot harder today to be an artist, and there's mental health implications. And I would use the example of, I was speaking with Ryan Dusick from Maroon 5. He basically had a breakdown, left the band, got his degree, and now he's a licensed therapist, which I think is a wonderful narrative in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
But we were talking about how it used to be easy, well, sort of easy. You know, decades ago, you would write a great song, you would get popular in your city, maybe in your region, and the goal was just to get signed, and then all your problems were gone, you know? Well, today, and you know this better than anyone, not only do you have to write and record amazing music, but you have to play live, you have to do publicity things. And then there's all this social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. I mean, it's like, you can't do everything. You just can't, I mean, as a human being, talk about how you manage that avalanche of roles and responsibilities and all of this data, like you mentioned. How do you parse all of that?
Well, I think I deal with it in two ways. The first is that I use social media in a rather limited capacity, which is to say I post things related to my work and I'm off. My friends know this about me. I do not watch, like, I don't think I've watched an Instagram story in like 4 months or something. Like my girlfriend was out on tour for like a month and she had to text me. She was like, "What? Can you please watch my story? Like I'm in and out because I just have to use this thing as like, it's part of my work. It's part of how I communicate with my fans and how I publicize what I'm up to. And I have to kind of draw that line just for me. That's where I can keep a healthy like boundary with it. I'm sure my career would, you know, I'm sure there'd be benefit if I did more, but which leads me to my second point, which is, and I'll screen this. You could put a little like reverb and delay on me on this one. Like there will never be enough. Like you get to anywhere, you know, you're a small artist, you're starting out and you think like, well, I'll do this and I'll do this and then I'll be happy. Then I'll be satisfied. Then you get to that place inevitably and you go, well, actually now I need this. Now I need this. Okay. Well, then you get to that place and then you go, well, okay, now I need this. Now I need this. You know, you get 100 followers, then 1,000, then 10,000, then 100,000. Then you need like, if you buy into this kind of if then thinking, there will never be enough, and you're kind of in the trap, and you can really, you know, you'll never extricate yourself. So you have to like self extricate from that type of thinking, in my opinion. So I try to just not engage with that, and I try to like zoom out, and I try to see social media as one component of what I do. Not that it's irrelevant, because I do think it's relevant. And it's a way that like, especially people who like live in cities and places I have never toured and haven't had a chance to travel to, like that's the only way they're ever going to get to interact with like my live show is seeing a video online. And so that stuff matters to me, but I try not to put too much time and energy into the vicissitudes of the internet. And I don't really read comments. I'm just kind of, again, I'm in and out. It's like I treat Instagram like CVS. Like, you know, I buy my like makeup remover cloths and I pick up my, you know, migraine prescription and I'm out. Like that's what I'm up to.
I want to go back to the new album, and in an interview you did a few months ago, you called yourself I think the term was a born again musician. Like you had a reference to the born again Christian, not that you were born again Christian, but you're born again musician. And maybe it seemed like you had a new perspective. You talked about getting rid of preconceived notions and expectations, and how did that influence how this album came to be and the songs you wrote, being a born-again musician?
Well, I should note, I'm a never-born Christian. I was actually raised in an a-religious environment. So I'm kind of like, I don't know anything about religion beyond what I've read, but I haven't experienced it. That's just a fun fact about me. So to be reborn is to be imbued with total zeal, fervor, curiosity, joy, you know, all those things. And so I felt like I was making a debut record. I think it informed the process. Like I just didn't have a ton of judgment. In a good way, like I wasn't self-censoring or self-judging, going, man, that's a stupid idea. Don't do that. That sucks. That lyric, oh my God. What are people going to think of this? This, you know, those types of voices, which can, you know, pretty easily and inevitably weasel their way into your head and sometimes are useful to an extent. They just kind of like were very quiet. And I was able to inhabit the place of, like making. And so I think it informed the record in that it came together really quickly. You know, I lost hearing in my ear, and I had a record out a year late. I had a record out, like released on a vinyl pressing a year after that, which, like, if for anyone who knows anything about like the how slow things are to make, like, it's quick. So it was just, you know, there was an urgency, like, you know, when you just, you know, when you learn something new and you're like, oh my God, I have to do it. Like, I have to use this skill I have, and I have to make this thing. I have to, like, I learned how to juggle. Now I got to show everyone that I got to juggle. That's kind of how I felt. And so it was really, really great. And I just, you know, to speak briefly again on kind of the internet and the ways that can kind of cloud the experience of being creative, and those concerns, like, of marketing or social media or whatever, it was so far from my mind. And that's a really great place, I think, to create from, and can be hard to get to when you're, you know, five records in, basically. And so I just felt like I was very grateful to be able to tap into that.
You know, the song, before we hit record, I was telling you that the song that sort of stopped me dead in my tracks, and a lot of it to me is energetic, and it's fun, and it's genre bending, and it's unexpected. And, you know, I love it when I can't predict where a song is going. You know, I think the worst thing, the most boring thing, is that 1-4-5, you just kind of know exactly where the chorus is going. You know where everything is. And Mono is not like that, but the one that I get goosebumps listening to is Perfectly Alone. And lyrically, you know, again, I mentioned earlier to you that lyrics are really important to me, and not everybody can write really great lyrics. It's a lost art sometimes. And to be honest, sometimes the audience doesn't want to hear well-written lyrics. But talk a little bit about Perfectly Alone, because that song, it just stunned me when I got to that. And I think it's the last song on the album.
It is. It's the closer. And yeah, we chatted a little before we started recording. The scene that I was initially describing when I started working on this song was my experience immediately after getting off stage, which is... it's a very unique experience. You know, most people don't do this for their job, but I go from, you know, being on stage playing my last song, which is usually like crowd is the loudest, every energy is at its apex, and I get brought to a room, like green room or the bus or whatever, and my tour managers, you know, make sure I'm okay, you okay, I'm okay, right? And I'm a solo artist. So then essentially in about 2 minutes, everyone leaves because everyone has to go do their job, whatever their role is on the tour. And so I'm just, you know, I've gone from kind of being with a million people to being with no people, well, being with one people, me, are arguably the scariest people to be with, yourself. And, that used to be a really fraught situation for me. I used to be really, really uncomfortable with that because it was a moment where I felt like, oh, here I went. I tried to feel not alone, right? I went in a big room and I made music and I sang it with all these people. And yet, here I am. I'm actually just alone, right? Like, you know, it sort of felt like a little slap in the face. And that feeling, that discomfort has been a real place of reckoning for me in my adult life and in my maturing as a person. And I've been able to reach a place of peace with that. And that's really what that song is meant to feel like. It is meant to feel like that journey I have been on. And I think there's so much power, personal power, generative power in without, you know, for me, without alcohol, without loud music, without anything, being able to sit in this body and go, there are mysteries of this existence, many of them, all of them, pretty much. I'll never have any idea what they're about. Like, I don't know what happens after I die. And like, I am going to die. And so is everybody that I know. Like, this is crazy. You know, like, these are the thoughts going through my head after I get off stage. I'm not even kidding. Like, I'm just in it. And I'm like, can I just sit here? Can I be with that? Can I be in this moment in all of its strangeness and beauty and sadness, you know? And the answer is like a big resounding yes. And once you kind of hear that yes inside of yourself, you're like, oh, okay. Like, I'm ready, you know? And there's a lot of, I think I've derived a lot of confidence and self-esteem from really facing that, some of those fears just really directly. I know it's kind of an age-old adage, I suppose, but like just sitting and looking the things you're scared of in the eye, and doing that with, you know, a clear mind, it's very powerful. So I hope people, you know, when the record ends, they feel powerful. That's the hope.
You're kind of describing something like meditation, being alone by yourself, having an awareness, mindfulness, being comfortable with whatever thoughts cross your mind. Do you meditate at all?
I'm an inconsistent meditator. I would love to be more consistent, but I certainly know the practice, and there are many ways in which, you know, I try to integrate that kind of the practice of, you know, observing thought, present focus into my way of being.
I just had one last question. I was looking at the artwork for the album Mono. I'm looking at some of the new merch that's come out. And it's really original. It's different. It's striking. I'd like to talk about the creative process. How involved are you with that? The album cover, I would love to know what the thought process was behind the almost like the magician sort of chop you in half sort of box. And then, you know, some of the merch, you know, the Are You Serious and kind of the retro photo and the verbiage and all of that stuff. Are you involved deeply in that creative process as well? And tell me a little bit about how that album cover came together, because when you're going through looking at albums, it definitely pops. It definitely stands out.
Thank you. I'm very involved. I have a creative director, Pearl, who I've been collaborating with on this whole record cycle. The album cover, I have the drawing I made somewhere. I did it at her house. We were talking about concepts. I had made an initial kind of mood board of like, this is where my head's at. And where my head was, you know, okay, anyone who's experienced a loss, a big loss of a person, you know, in the case for me with this record, with my hearing, it feels like a bad magic trick. You're like, what? You're like, where the fuck did that go? You know, it's like, wait, rewind the tape. Like, I know, you know, I remember like early on when my biological dad died when I was, you know, young. And I remember being like, no, really? Like, you know, just sort of this, like this disbelief, it almost feels impossible. And I wanted to tap into the, like the magic trickness of loss and then, and really play with these ideas of two and one, right? The splitting, separation, and how do we represent that visually? And I drew just basically a very I'm a horrible drawer. I drew a version of what the cover might look like. It's very similar to what the cover does look like. And Pearl just helped me, you know, she really drew out of me. I think one of the things that a creative director does well is they ask the questions. You know, they know how to draw out of the artist that they're working with or their collaborators. Like, they know how to poke those right things and kind of elicit that. So that was how we came up with that concept and where it came from. And as far as, you know, the other creative stuff goes, ad mats and merch. So most of my merch and ad mats, I collaborate with an artist named Alex Muhammad, and he's based up in Canada. And we just, you know, kind of trade ideas back and forth on Photoshop. We've got our little Pinterest boards and we collaborate. And I find that creates the best product. It allows me to like experiment, give feedback, play around with things. And so that's the process. The past few records, that's been kind of the approach. And I've really, you know, I really like it. And I think I enjoy elements of graphic design, but I'm not like, you know, I'm not a graphic designer in all caps, but I have that skill set just because I had to learn, you know, so.
It's been inspiring. I really enjoyed speaking with you, Christine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.